One Last Sketch podcast. I'm Michael.
I'm Marie, and it's my birthday.
And I'm Corey, and happy birthday, Marie.
Happy Yay. Birthday!
For my birthday, I agreed to do a podcast of the new sun.
Originally came out in the 80s as a four-book series. More recently, most reprints are collected in two books. But I think it's safe to say that you can't really talk about any of these books individually, and it should be considered as one very long work.
If you treat the first book as a standalone novel, it's not that good. If you treat it as the first part of a much denser work, then it works.
I'd say none of it would really make any sense in isolation from the rest. It should really only be considered as the Book of the New Sun.
Yeah.
In terms of spoilers, while I would urge you to have read these books before listening to this podcast, I also think that the Book of the New Sun may very well be spoiler-proof.
Yeah, because even if we tell you what happens, you're not going to understand it anyway.
Now, I would normally make a disclaimer about the books we do being very old at this point, but the first one came out in 1980, so that's probably recent enough that you couldn't quite complain, but you could be annoyed.
Yeah, and when you read it, you'll be like, where's the bits they talked about? Because you won't recognize them when they happen. It's a very special book. It's great. It's odd. It's different. It is like no other piece of text.
It's very unique. It's good. It's very good. It's just unique in some strange ways at times.
See, we can't even describe it. This is why Gene Wolfe had to use sort of words to describe the actual words that his narrator was using, but I'm probably getting ahead of us.
Yeah, as listeners can already tell, we're already stumbling over ourselves just trying to describe the experience of reading this. It's not actually that popular, I would say. It's well known in science fiction circles among writers and really hardcore fans. But in terms of influence, I don't know how influential it's actually been because there's never been anything quite like it since.
Mm-hmm. It's been very influential within its own genre. I know Ursula K. Le Guin speaks highly of it, and the copies I have a quote from Neil Gaiman on the front cover. So it's like, again, the hardcore sci-fi nerds would probably know it. More of the casual fan who might just browse the sci-fi shelf, it might not be the kind of thing they'd pick up.
It's certainly not something that anyone who just kind of reads, I'd say, like, regular fiction would ever read. They'd probably get a couple paragraphs in and say, what is this, and put it down.
Meanwhile, for people who really like dense, deep, literary fiction...
But not dry.
And you wanted to introduce them to some kind of science fiction fantasy work. I guess this is best described as science fantasy, but we'll get to that.
If you like to put in as much work into reading a book as the author put into writing it, this is the book for you.
It's the War and Peace of science fiction.
Yes, I would say that this is a good book to hand to somebody who just likes really dense, beautiful writing, complex plots, complex postmodernist kind of games. I'm going to attempt to give the basic premise. This is the Earth, spelt with a U, but it's our Earth. A few million years in the future, Earth has had its galactic empire. It has fallen. The sun is on its way to becoming a red giant. The Earth is dying. Civilization is crumbling. In this strange world of the far, far, far future, our main character, Severian, becomes autarch of one of the countries, and he is describing a story of how he got there. It's in first person. He says he has perfect recall. It becomes clear that maybe that's not the case later on.
Or he's lying. He lies a lot.
Or he's lying. And he goes on adventures and eventually goes steps towards becoming a messiah figure who will bring about a renewed sun that will let the Earth continue for another few million years. if he does his job correctly.
Mm-hmm. He's also a jerk.
he is a jerk, yes.
This was my introduction to Gene Wolfe. I think I only read maybe 2 short stories by him beforehand that hadn't made much of an impression. This certainly made an impression, but I'd be interested what your first impressions were going into it, because you guys both read it because I recommended it to you, and I should say it comes as no surprise to anyone who reads my blog that I recommend this book all the time and consider it one of my favorite works of fiction ever. But I'd be interested to know what you guys thought going in and then finishing and coming out of it.
Yeah, I remember going in, I'd read, I think it was 2 or 3 Gene Wolfe stories in an anthology. Like you said, I found they had very little impact. They were just short stories. They were mixed in with a bunch of other stuff. So I thought, okay, I don't know that I would give him another chance. But you spoke so highly of these that I'm like, okay, maybe I should try it. It was interesting going in. I mean, especially from the get-go, you can see a lot of like the hallmarks of a traditional fantasy adventure narrative. But if you really pay attention, it becomes apparent fairly quickly how those just kind of collapse, and that he's not embracing the cliches. He's actually completely messing with you by making you think he's playing with or embracing the cliches. And by the time I finished reading it, it was one of those books where it was, again, it was really good, but I had to kind of sit down for a few hours and just let my brain heal just to try to contextualize what happened.
I remember when you put the book down upon finishing, you kind of put it down, then had this world-weary sigh come out of you. You were sort of silent for a half an hour thinking about it.
And Marie?
Well, I read it after Corey read it, because I thought, heck, this will be a nice break from the Red Mars trilogy.
This will be a nice, easy read.
Oh, God, I had no idea. But the upshot of going into something like this, eyes wide open, is I actually very much enjoyed it. And to be honest, I think it is lighter reading than some other things in terms of the text is enjoyable to get through. What I noticed immediately was it kind of reminded me of A Clockwork Orange, where there's made-up language things like nouns, adjectives, words that aren't normal words being used in a strange way to indicate a different language that we don't know. And it was really obvious from the beginning that half his words don't mean what the actual definition term of those words mean. And as I went through, there are appendices in there. I actually skipped the most useful appendix, the one at the end of the second book, and got to the end of the whole thing, and then realized that I'd skipped that appendix, went back, and such is the storytelling of Gene Wolfe, is that even though I had not actually had been given an official definition of how he was using some of his words, I had still figured it out, more or less, what those words meant. And I found it, the initial narrative in the first book is pretty kind of clear, then the second book I found diffused a lot, and if I had not known that the payoff was going to be worth it, I probably would have stopped there. But from the third book, which is, I think, my favorite one, on through the fourth, the narrative pace comes together. Everything crashes up beautifully into an amazing payoff that you really just can't describe. You have to read this book yourself.
Gene Wolfe does a slow build very well in the series, or in the book. And one thing I noticed from the beginning is it is very dense writing. It's not the kind of thing you can just sit there and go page through for hour after hour until you're done it. But at the same time, it's very beautiful writing, despite the fact that the character might not always be the most articulate of people, and it is from his perspective. You still get these very ornate, very beautifully written passages, but they're not purple. They're not excessive. They're just well done.
Yeah, this is one of the few books where I would go back over passages and read them out loud, just to hear and really dwell on the language that was being used. I did not find it as difficult to get through the beginning, insofar as I didn't really have much clue what was going on by the end of the first book. But the language and prose was so strong on that level that the writing alone was able to carry me through until stuff started falling into place. If that makes sense.
It is at least written by, I'd say, a master of English writing, so it helps it work well when it's something this difficult conceptually. Because really, I mean, in your premise, it really is a fantasy. It is a science fiction book just told as if it were a fantasy, but it isn't. And yet it is.
Now, considering that Gene Wolfe is such a master of the English language, he actually came to writing fairly late in his life. And it was one of those cases where he just caught the writing bug in his 30s and started producing amazing work fairly quickly. I will go over the genesis of the Book of the New Sun, because it is kind of a funny story, in that Gene Wolfe would go to conventions and see people dressed up as their favorite science fiction characters, and he thought, what would be a costume that people could wear to conventions to show that they're fans of my book? It has to be an easy costume to make. So it immediately came into his mind, well, a cloak and a mask and a sword, which is the costume of Severian the Apprentice Torturer.
It's probably worth pointing out...
Journeyman. He's a journeyman.
Yes, he becomes a journeyman. Pants are part of this costume, and the only reason I'm specifying pants is because he doesn't wear a shirt. I think I was like halfway through the third book before I figured that out.
See, since he never put on a shirt, I just assumed he wasn't wearing one. Yeah, but I'm like that.
And that's not because he's a macho badass who thinks he doesn't wear a shirt. That's actually part of his guild uniform, is they don't wear shirts. It's that image of the stoic executioner whose mask or whose face you don't see because he's hooded. No shirt, ripped muscles, and a big-ass axe, except in this case it's a sword.
Mm-hmm. And what's really surprising about a book that this is this complicated and seems to have been plotted out to the every minute of the plot was slotted into place is that this started as a novella.
Yeah.
Or Gene Wolfe had the idea, I'm going to write a novella about this guy who my fans will have an easy time dressing up as. And it just went from there, and it kept on getting longer and longer and longer.
He got wildly out of his control.
As you said, this is probably one of those cases where a lot of the writing happened in the rewrites, because with how perfectly it fits together.
One thing, people, if you're reading this, any given half clause of a sentence in this book can be actually the most important information drop. But you won't know that until you're done. You'll be like, what? Wait, that guy? That guy that walked by them in the... What? That wasn't important?
Yeah, you'll be in volume 4, and you're back paging through volume 1 looking for the half sentence that gave you that crucial detail. And it's kind of frustrating, but in a very fun way.
I didn't have to page. I found I just remembered, because it would just sort of draw out. He'd be like, remember that thing? And I'd be like, yeah, I do remember that thing. Oh my god, I can't believe that thing is actually a thing.
So we've already gone over the first talking point that I had written down in my outline, which is that this is a science fiction novel that's written as a traditional fantasy.
Oh, and I'm sorry, I stole that.
It starts out as a very kind of typical sword and sorcery tale, especially because the setting has already been used by Jack Vance in the Dying Earth tales, even though it's far more complicated.
If I'm not mistaken, in the Jack Vance stories, there's kind of an understanding, like an actual understanding that the world is ending. In the Book of the New Sun, everyone's always praying, oh, we hope for the new sun, we hope for the new sun, the world is ending, the world is ending. But they believe it not as like a... It wasn't a factual thing they understood and knew was coming. It felt more like they understood it as in the terms of a superstition. They feared it was happening, they knew on some primal level, but they didn't actually have the understanding to know that, yes, this is definitively going to happen.
The sort of sense of atmosphere that I got was that most people are really just plebs in this, they don't have any kind of appreciation of the actual world around them, and the whole dying sun and or new sun is just a fairy tale as far as they're concerned, and this is their world, and they're kind of, I'd say, almost a little bit not debauched. What's that ethical group that's pain, pleasure?
Hedonists.
They're just kind of basic people. They're not involved in anything else. And they're just there. So the boredom is almost just complete ignorance, I found. It's very dusty, sort of falling apart.
They're kind of your typical dirt farming peasants that always appear in this type of story who don't understand the world at large. And this is just the particular story they tell themselves to explain why their lives suck.
On the other hand, Severian himself does not understand many of the things going on around him, and it makes a very interesting narrative style in that he is narrating the story as somebody in the Dark Ages, essentially, in this kind of medieval-esque, semi-feudal, far-future autarky, where he doesn't things that are far-future technologies are basically just magic to him, and that's how he understands them, because he was never told what these were.
Mm-hmm. Well, isn't Carl Sagan the one who's got that beautiful line about sufficiently advanced technology being indistinguishable from magic? Like,
yeah.
This is very much that concept taken literally.
An example of this effect is at the beginning of the story, Severian is an apprentice torturer in the Madican Tower.
Mm-hmm.
And the Madican Tower has a bulkhead because it's the remnants of a spaceship.
It is. It's so
he understands it as a tower. We read it starting out as a tower because we go sword and sorcery story. It's just a tower. Yeah. But no, it's a spaceship.
It is definitely a spaceship. Is that there are so that reveal becomes almost so constant that your brain gets worn out thinking about all these things that you initially thought of as a fantasy element are in fact a science fiction element. And after a while, I almost had a certain brain fatigue of, well, everything is just sciency, and I don't know why. What? Arg!
There's another part, he's describing these strange mirrors, and he keeps going on about the mirrors, the mirrors, the mirrors, and then somebody steps into them. And I don't mean, like, physically steps through the mirror. I mean steps into, like, little platforms surrounded by them. It's a teleporter. Like, yeah. It is your classic Star Trek teleporter being described as these strange mirrors.
But the mirrors also had to kind of do with, like, bending light and space and time in that space and stuff, so...
And there's just one really great scene where he's in this hallway where there's paintings hung up on the wall. And you have a description of this person on a barren landscape wearing armor and he's planting a flag.
Oh, yes, yeah.
That is. That's actually a photograph of the moon landing.
Neil Armstrong, yep. That's right.
It is.
I think just one other good example, too. This happens fairly early on. Shortly after Severian is made a journeyman torturer, he has to help torture someone. And they put her into this device, and it's like this weird glow, and then it's like, oh, yes, you're in a lot of pain now, but you'll be dead in about a month. And I'm like, I'm pretty sure she just got some radiation poisoning.
Well, the whole thing with that device, which is called the Revolutionary, is that it somehow turned your unconscious mind against yourself and made you try to kill yourself unconsciously, was, I thought, the whole thing with that.
Yeah. This is the very important character, Thecla, who has a rather twisted relationship with Severian and just keeps on coming back.
But you don't know how twisted that relationship is until book four, when they realize that their great academic friendship was in fact mad sex. So
yeah, I was gonna say in the first part, Severian's always describing effectively how chaste the relationship is. Oh, we were great friends, blah 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 blah. It's like a schoolboy crush. He'll look but he'll never touch. And as Marie pointed out, they were acting like rabbits the whole time.
Yep.
Yes. Now, for my second point, which we also covered just a little bit, was the use of language and the specific use of obscure words by Gene Wolfe to describe things that don't exist but kind of are the same.
Well,
or used in the same way.
Yeah, the reason for doing that is all of the words he uses that are unfamiliar are actually real English language words. He doesn't make up any technobabble. He doesn't slap any consonants together and say, this is a new language. They're real words, and the reason for doing that is that the premise of the book is that it's being translated by Gene Wolfe from a language that doesn't exist yet. Mm-hmm. So to kind of compensate for that, instead of, you know, creating new words, he actually uses archaisms.
Yeah, Fulligan is a good one for black. Blacker than black.
It is the color that is darker than black.
Destrier is great because it makes you think big horse. It's really more like a horse-like monster with fangs, claws, and can run faster than a bullet.
If you could somehow crossbreed a tiger, a horse, and some kind of very high-caliber projectile weapon, that's effectively what this thing is.
Yeah.
Like,
again,
it's really weird.
Not fully apparent until the fourth book, what those things look like.
What is great about the translation conceit is that it's entirely plausible because Severian tosses that manuscript from a time-traveling spaceship.
Yes, he does.
I was a little hazy on why he did that, but yeah.
My God.
Yeah, true. Well,
he's the autarch at that point, so...
I would comment on that more, but we're going to actually talk about the narration in a minute, so I'll say that.
Yeah.
Yes, I should also draw attention to the slanted Latin that is also used.
Oh, yes. I was really confused for a while, because terminus est does not mean the dividing line, as they say. I'm like, terminus est is like, this is the end. It is the thing. It sort of means the kind of the phrase that he's getting at, but it doesn't really mean the phrase that he's getting at. And that keeps coming up over and over again.
And just to clarify why that's important, Terminus Est is Severian's sword, and because his job is to torture and execute people, it is what he uses to execute them. The descriptions of it, it's a very long blade, but it has a flat, square tip. There's no stabbing point. As far as I can tell, this is an actual type of blade that did exist, was used for executions, and in the modern age, it's more used as a symbol of authority by various courts to show that, yes, we do have this power.
It also has a mercury and air core, so that weight can shift as it's being swung, which is kind of a funky idea. And it has a male and a female side, and it's so sharp, it might as well be a monofilament. There's a pretty impressive thing that... one impressive execution that Severian carries out, I think it's one of the two described, is there's a woman sitting on a stool. He breaks her legs with the flat of the blade, and then whips the sword around horizontally and cuts off her head. Which is an impressive feat of strength, but also just an impressive piece of technology that it could do that.
And having seen demonstrations of skilled swordsmen cutting bamboo and mats that have been bound together, to make a parallel cut like that is not easy. So it was kind of an impressive moment for Severian. Mm-hmm. Although what I think the funniest thing regarding the sword is it describes him shaving with it. This is also described as being a 4-foot blade that probably weighs in excess of 20 pounds.
Yeah, but Severian's pretty ripped.
Yeah, that was, he said that was the whole point of him shaving with it, was that if he could not handle his sword like that, it was a workout, and also if it was not sharp enough to shave with, then he should be ashamed to care it. Also, I think he was being a bit intimidating at that point.
Yeah.
But going back to the slanted Latin,
yes,
this gives every phrase that's rendered in Latin double meanings, the one that Severian gives it, mm-hmm. and what it actually means.
Yes.
I guess it's worth mentioning at this point that the geographic location of this is far future South America.
There's a lot of mate being drunk. All over the place.
Yeah, there are a few passages he starts talking about, oh, they were drinking tea, and then I realized it was just the mate that the peasants drank. Mm-hmm. And he describes it like the gourds you used to drink mate out of and the spoons and all this other stuff. But
yeah, and a lot of the cultural traditions and material culture here are South American and also very Catholic, which is not surprising because Gene Wolfe is Catholic.
Well, I was going to say South America in general has very strong Catholic traditions.
Which is probably why he said it there.
I wanted to actually add something about the language. Because Gene Wolfe also uses common words in an unusual way. And he says specifically, I think in his first appendix, that the word metal doesn't always mean metal. It just means, it can mean any kind of future material that may in fact be a plastic, or a metal, or some carbon thing, or just something. So it's...
Or a superconducting piece of ceramic, or...
You have to guess what it is from the context.
Or a ship can refer to a sea ship, or it can refer to a spaceship.
Well, they're very detailed descriptions of sailing, and then at the end they'll mention how it's between worlds. Mm-hmm. So, it's very much nautical terminology used to describe space travel.
And you need to really pay attention to the language... and how it's being used.
And there's a wonderful thing about this use of language is that when you meet the sort of countries from the north, the Askians,
yes.
You learn that they speak only in phrases from a phrase book of like almost like communist manifesto kind of things. And that is their language. And somehow that is how they have a normal conversation like, hello, I am home from work. How are you doing? That would come out in... these phrases. And you know what? After reading the whole book of this thing, I can honestly believe that would work.
They string together what seem these rote phrases coming together as gibberish, where it just sounds like they don't have any personality. They've been completely absorbed into this communal society. But it turns out that they're using the phrases and combining them in ways that creates meaning for each person. And it's their own language. Which, it doesn't sound like that to an outsider, it sounds like they're praising their philosophy and so forth.
What's interesting about that is it very much touches on some ideas George Orwell had in 1984 about how if you control how the language is structured, you can control how people can express themselves with it. So it's like, if the language doesn't have a word for a concept or an idea, you can't express that concept or idea. Here, it's effectively that whole Orwell's entire idea inverted. You've got people who can only express certain rote, memorized phrases that are supposed to have set meanings, and yet they're still finding a way to construct a language of their own within that.
I envision a lot of gestures.
It's an incredibly cool idea and shows the kind of language games that Gene Wolfe plays, which I think dovetails nicely into our next point, which is Severian's own use of language and his status as an unreliable narrator.
So my
first question, does he have perfect recall, as he tells us at the beginning?
To not provide a direct answer at the moment, just to get into some literary theory here, it's taken as a granted in English studies that first-person narratives can't be trusted. You cannot trust a first-person narrator, and that's part of the appeal of that type of storytelling, obviously, because you've only got their word for it. It's like if somebody's telling you, oh, this is what happened, how much actually happened, how much is that embellishment, how much is that their imagination? And I did a little side research. Gene Wolfe loves that idea, which is why he did it in this book. And you can't trust half of what Severian says, but you've got nothing else to go on.
And what's great is that it becomes extremely obvious as Severian's writing. Initially, I initially thought he had perfect recall because he said so. Then I began to doubt the perfect recall because I was noting inconsistencies. Now I think he does, in fact, have perfect recall. But as he's writing, his level of excitement would sometimes bat away his filters that he had initially planned to, you know, not mention his relationship with Thecla, not mention the certain things about other people that he's interacted with, not mention some of the terrible, terrible things he has done, in fact. But they slip through because he's forgotten in his excitement and absorption in his writing of this treatise.
That's similar to how I read it. I do think he has perfect recall. I also think he's very selective in what he lets you know.
Mm-hmm. I would like to add another layer of complication to this, in that Severian, later on in his life, starts losing his status as a distinct personality. His mind becomes inhabited by an increasing number of other people that are dissolving his own self.
Yes.
So he might, in fact, have lost all sense of the past in this entangled web of memories that he ends up inheriting.
And for the gore fans, he gets this ability by drinking a special chemical and then eating the front lobe of someone's brain.
Yes.
Yeah, I want to specifically reference his confusion upon becoming Thecla, his first effective torture victim and his first quote-unquote love, through this eating this Elzebo or ingesting this Elzebo chemical. Yeah, he's then unable to control his own recollections because he can't make them fit his self-shaped narratives because she keeps on butting in and he can't really reconcile the two halves of himself at that moment. So even Severian has difficulty sorting out his jumble of internal and external memories into something approaching a coherent story, even though he tries. He really tries.
Yeah. Well, and I was going to say, that happens twice, actually. So there's the first time, which is just Thecla, where he takes these chemicals, he eats a piece of her, which was kind of, again, gross, but it happened. And then later on, I mentioned eating the brain. When he eats the brain, it's only of one person, but it's of one person who's storing the collected memories through this process of, you know, probably tens of thousands.
Mm-hmm. And there's also the whole thing about the fact that Severian is, maybe he's also Severian, but he's also a mythological figure called Conciliator at the same time, which in some ways makes him different from the other people in this world who eat the dead and to take on their memories, because it seems that for him, when he ate the piece of Thecla's flesh, he in fact incarnated her to the point that sometimes people don't see Severian, they see Thecla, even though they're looking at him, and because she will manifest in his position. But that also gets into his ability as a conciliator, which is to bend time, I think of maybe a little bit space, time and space being the same thing after a certain time amount of science theory, and then thus being able to, you know, bring back the dead or heal wounds and all these things.
I should say that he's not the conciliator yet.
But he was, and
but
will be.
But he will become the conciliator, and the conciliator is a mythological figure from the past.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a major step in that test to bring about the new sun, is that the Autarch, has to be an Autarch who does the test to bring about the new sun, has to also be the conciliator.
Yes.
To get this done.
Yes.
We told you it was confusing. I'm sure even people who read the book are going to have difficulty threading our own thoughts and what they think about this too.
Weren't you telling me that it's not apparent in the Book of the New Sun, but if you read the one that comes after...
There is a fifth book called The Earth of the New Sun.
Yeah, if you read that, you were telling me that you learned that Severian was in the past, and that's why some people seem very familiar to him in the Book of the New Sun, because they had met him in the past. But when Severian meets them for his first time, he's like, what?
Just to backtrack a bit, we're talking about Severian as the unreliable narrator. I think just a good example of that from the text is there's one part, I think it's in the second book, second or third, he thinks he has disgusted this woman who he's kind of in love with. I mean, they're living together, they're sleeping together. And he thinks that he has disgusted her and horrified her and alienated her through his profession, when in fact her mind is broken because of some other stuff that becomes important later. And so to defend himself, he's explaining to her, he goes on this like multi-page rant about the importance of what he does, which is to torture people. He is the instrument of capital corporeal punishment. At the end of the book, when he becomes a conciliator, the first thing he does, well, not the first thing, but one of the first things he does is abolishes corporeal punishment. He's like, no, you're not going to torture people anymore. You are just going to execute them. So he's going on this rant almost to convince himself, and then he completely changes his mind anyway. So you can't help but wonder when you hear the decision, how much did he believe it the first time?
Also, that woman is his grandmother.
Yeah, again, confusing.
There's a bit at the end of the fourth book where you kind of go, ew! They had a lot of sex.
They meet in the first book. He's floating through this lake that's used to harvest that's used to store dead bodies. Suddenly, this woman is trying to grab him because she thinks she's drowning. He pulls her out. Through various things, he brought her back to life. They shack up for a little while. Stuff unfolds, and it turns out that this is his grandmother who died while she was quite young.
Yeah,
and we don't know why she got resurrected until quite far along in the narrative, too. I think in the second book you find out, he had the claw of the conciliator.
Yes, because thorns.
Which got stolen, and this has the power to resurrect and heal people. Yeah, One of them being Dorcas, his grandmother. But while we're on the topic of Severian, it's worth noting that he's a really unpleasant person. Not only to start out with, even after absorbing all these memories and going through this incredibly complex spiritual and physical journey, but he's also really compelling, which means you end up reading along despite the fact that, first, he's lying to you regularly, and second, considering the horrible stuff he's willing to admit, what kind of terrible stuff did he do that he glosses over?
There's one bit in particular where he's in a boat with a character called Yolenta, I don't know, floating down a river. She's described as beautiful. And then he kind of has
unconscious.
And unconscious. Then he has sex with her a lot, he says. But I'm like, wow, you know, from what I know of you now and what I suspect, I think he just raped her for quite a while down
that
boat.
Oh, no, that there is no mystery there. That's one of the things he admits. Yeah, so just to recap, he admits to torturing people, he admits to killing a lot of people, he admits to raping a girl, and that's what this very unreliable character is willing to admit.
Yeah.
And this is, I'd like to point out, this is where the great irony comes in. This is a messiah figure.
Yeah. Also, he's pretty horrible towards women constantly, actually.
Yeah, he's a bit of a pig.
He's a huge chauvinist.
He's pretty horrible towards everyone, I feel.
Let me see if I've got this right. We've got rape, murder, torture, execution, incest, and a messiah figure. Kind of makes you wonder how different things would have been if the Bible had been written this way. Like, I don't know. Maybe that's part of the thought exercise of the book. I don't know. Maybe Gene Wolfe is saying, like, okay, here's how crazy things could have been, but I have no evidence for that. But
yeah.
It's also playing into the idea of redemption in this case.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Extreme redemption. This is a really extreme example of a redemption narrative.
You need more than Mr. Klee's magic eraser for this guy.
Well, yeah. Again, it's a redemption narrative. I'm not sold on the redemption actually being found. It's like, oh, great, you're this messiah figure. You're still a like horrible human being.
I think he puts on the clothes of redemption, as it were, but he's still the same horrible person inside that he's always been.
Yeah. Well, again, that's where the fifth book comes in, and he becomes the conciliator, who mm-hmm. is the actual messiah figure that he himself had looked up to at the beginning of this story. He has to undo all the terrible things that he has done in order to bring about a renewal of the sun and this planet that he's being put in charge of, effectively. Again, something I thought that was clear would happen at the end of the fourth book. But
yeah, I saw it quite a bit at the end of the fourth book. I mean, I know the fifth book is written as a sequel, not to book four, but to the series overall. I haven't read it.
It's definitely a coda in that I don't think you have to read it.
No, I was actually very satisfied with this ending. It's like, okay, he's going to go fix things now, because that's not the interesting part of the story. The interesting part of the story is, and now I fix it. The interesting part of the story is watching this very flawed person get to a position where he's able to fix it.
Yeah.
Not to say that The Earth of the New Sun isn't an interesting and worthy book to read, because I totally think it is.
Fair enough.
But yeah, this I think these four books in the, well, one really long narrative in itself does resolve itself fairly well by the end. But you need to be paying pretty close attention to get that feeling of satisfaction.
Yeah.
You know what? I'm going to dispute that a little bit. I mean, I pay fairly close attention when I read, but I also have moments where I'll miss stuff. And even when I'm adding up at the end, it's like, okay, I must have missed that. I must have missed this. This I definitely remember. I was still very satisfied with it.
It does a very good job of sweeping you along, even if you don't understand something, I found.
I have to admit that I was quite dense and didn't notice quite a lot of things that the both of you told me were eventually going on. Even so, it's still something that you can get enough out of that it's worth rereading it. That sort of is kind of an interesting thing, because isn't the quote about this from Gene Wolfe that he wanted to make a book that was worth rereading, that would reward people doing that over and over again?
He says that a good book is one that rewards rereading.
Yeah, so the narrative is intentionally constructed to encourage you to reread it, mm-hmm. which, quite frankly, I like his definition of good literature, of a good book. I mean, it makes you want to read it again, and I'm not going to do it anytime soon, but I would definitely return to this.
Oh, there's even, as soon as I put the book down, I was like, there's about five scenes that I'd like to take a look back at, because I want to check what was going on in those, because some of the scenes are just hilarious, actually, in what happens, and I'd like to reread those, but some of the scenes are like, I missed a major plot point, and I'd like to see how that actually came out.
Well, just as a good example of that, there's two characters, Baldanders and
Dr. Talos,
who you meet in the first volume, and it's this kind of weird relationship. You don't quite know what's going on with them. It's kind of hinted at that it's a Frankenstein thing, with Dr. Talos being this tiny little waif of a human who's Dr. Frankenstein, and Baldanders being the horrible monster that he created. As you get further and further, it actually turns out that Baldanders is the insane genius who's able to do all this amazing stuff, and that Dr. Talos is actually a thing he created. So you don't notice that until you're told it, but when you look back, you're like, oh my god, yes, this is where he was manipulating him, and this is where he was pulling his puppet strings, and it's like, all of these details.
Mm-hmm. It's a book that really gets into your head and under your skin.
In a good way, though.
Yeah.
Yeah. You finish it and you just kind of... Since I finished it a few years ago, I haven't really stopped thinking about it since then, which mm-hmm. I think is one of the highest recommendations you can give a novel, frankly.
Yeah.
or one of the highest complaints.
True. This is a really polarizing book, and mm-hmm. if you look at reviews online, a lot of people really hate it.
Oh, I was going to say, there's a lot of people who hate it, but there's also a lot of people of, man, I couldn't stand this, and man, I couldn't stop thinking about it, so I had to reread it, and oh my god, now I love it.
People are allowed to have their opinions, to be fair.
Of course. I'm not at all disputing that. I'm just saying, it seems to be a book that people who don't like it seem to come around after a while, too.
I mean, let me just play devil's advocate here. I can see why people wouldn't like it. It's very hard.
Yeah.
It's very labor-intensive to read. If you're a person who at all has trouble reading, you're not going to be able to do this book.
No.
It's just going to be too hard.
Well, Ursula K. Le Guin I read a quote from her one time in which she described Gene Wolfe as science fiction's Melville, Herman Melville, the guy that wrote Moby Dick. So, this is a similar kind of thing there. You've got a very dense, very layered narrative that is very hard to get into at times.
Yeah, and yeah. I say this: the second book is the hardest. Because the narrative diffuses into lots of things that are needed for later on, but not really lots that's clear of what's happening or why you should care. And it's not until he starts walking by himself again in the third book that you kind of start to follow along with him more.
The part I had the most trouble with was the first book, actually, because Severian is just such an idiot in it. Like, you read it and you're like, my God, you're stupid.
Very naive, yeah.
And you realize in retrospect that a lot of these moments where he seems like a naive idiot are just him covering up his own horribleness effectively. So, I mean, knowing that, I think I would enjoy it more. Mm-hmm. But on a first read through, it reads like he's a moron again and again and again. You're like, how are you not dead? How did you get four books if you're this stupid?
And then you get on later, you're like, oh, he wasn't just a moron. He's a jerk.
I think this brings us perfectly into the last talking point that I wanted to get to, which is the layered nature of the narrative. In that a different story is happening between the gaps of what Severian explicitly says, and it becomes clearer as you become more comfortable, first with the idea that he's lying to you, but second, that he's lying to you in a decipherable way.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very puzzle box kind of book in that fashion.
You know, I think there is a little bit of, maybe not a lot, but maybe just a little bit of a breakdown of the suspension of disbelief there, because if you take the premise, if you accept the premise, if you accept that this is a true story from the future, why would this person give you hints? They wouldn't. Like, they would write the kind of story, especially if you're as big an ass as Severian is, that makes you look as good as possible, which he doesn't do. So that's kind of the literary aspect of it coming through.
I think, though, that in response to that, it's his kind of mental breakdown of becoming all these personalities that would make him fall apart or forget or become excited as he's writing.
True.
And let these things come out.
True.
Because it doesn't
exactly
read like
what I was going to say.
It does not read like a tale that someone has proofed. It reads like a tale that somebody wrote once, put in the mailbox.
Okay, I'll concede your guys' point on that. I think I can agree with that.
Yay. I convinced somebody.
So, we're going to move on to our concluding thoughts here. Number one, this is a really weird book.
Yes.
it's fun weird.
It's really weird.
It's like a crazy uncle, though. He's always welcome at parties because he's interesting.
Yeah. In the books that Wolf wrote after this, he uses the same first-person conceit, and one of his favorite conceits to use is the unreliable narrator. And he inhabits his character's voices so thoroughly that the books read very differently. But in this one, Severian's voice comes through incredibly well.
Yes.
And it's something that would be incredibly hard to pull off. I can't even imagine writing something this complex in this voice, in this fashion, and coming out with something coherent at the end.
I was going to say, it kind of reminds me of what method actors do, where they slip into the headspace of their character, and I mean, you get some great performances, but some really weird people as a result. Like, I can't imagine writing a book like this on this scale with that approach and not coming away with a little mental damage.
It's a masterwork in literature. Yeah.
And
yeah.
What's great is that Gene Wolfe does this again in reverse in a later book series.
Oh,
the Latro books, which, unlike the Book of the New Sun, which takes place in the far future, takes place in the distant past during the time of the Persian Empire, and has the opposite conceit in which the narrator has no idea what's going on because he has constant memory loss. So he forgets everything that's past 24 hours and is writing things down in a scroll.
As they go. Okay.
He doesn't know what's going on, but the reader does because we're reading the scroll along with him. Whereas here, Severian presumably knows what's going on, but doesn't want us to.
It's very, as the writer knows what's going on, it's really clear at certain parts in the story that he didn't know what was happening just then. Can we talk about our favorite scenes now?
Yes, that was how we were going to close out.
Yes, because I have two really favorite scenes.
Okay. Were you going to do the statue?
Yeah.
Oh, damn, I wanted to do the statue.
No, no, not that.
Oh.
Just the ring.
Oh, well, in that case, can I...
Yeah, yeah. That was the Corey.
Sorry, there's one part, it describes they're walking through the Mount Severian and this kid he's picked up along the way, who supposedly is also named Severian, although I have my doubts,
mm-hmm.
Are walking through the mountains, and he describes the statue, and the statue towering over this mountain and over this bay and all this other stuff, and I'm like, wait a minute, they're in South America. Is this the Jesus statue in Rio? I think it's the Jesus statue. And then you find out it has two heads. It's like, damn it, it's not. But he had me so convinced that it was the Jesus statue.
And he was sitting, and it's very much, you can see Gene Wolfe kind of as the author back going, neener, 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 I got you.
Well, I think I'm going to interject at this point and say that the Andes, the mountains themselves, have been carved into giant statues of previous autarchs.
Yeah.
So there's one point where it seems like it's a metaphor when Severian describes the mountains as statues. And then he starts climbing one, and you go, oh, wait, it's actually a statue.
Yes.
And that's one of the first major shock moments for me.
Yeah.
And I would count that as one of my favorite scenes, is just that moment of, oh, my God.
I have two favorite scenes, and they're kind of closely related. They happen both in Sword of the Lictor, the third book. And... The one that happens first is how Gene Wolfe got rid of this kid. Because I was wondering how this little Severian kid, who actually I think was having a very good growth effect on Severian as a character. But what happens is that they're climbing the statue that we formerly thought was the Jesus statue, and it is not, because it had this golden ring on it. And Severian's like, ah, if we go up that statue, maybe that's gold leaf and we can peel it off and then we'll have some gold and that'll be handy. Because, you know, food... ability to do things by barter, whatever. And what's great in this scene is Severian's walking over to this ring. They've climbed up this statue figure. And the kid runs over, he puts his hand on the gold, and he's immediately zapped and fried. And it's surprising, because you just didn't expect that to happen. And it's really an example of how the word metal doesn't necessarily mean metal at all. But it's also kind of laugh-out-loud funny in a sad way, because this kid fries, he kind of... gets his ashy corpse sort of gets blown into the crevice between two fingers. Severian kind of goes down, looks at it, goes, huh, and then just starts walking off. It's just this very much sort of this great moment of Severian. You can just picture Severian as the character going, whoa, huh, well, moving on.
Well, the thing I found there is the kid wasn't really around long enough for you to form huge emotional attachment as the reader, and he's not...
I was sad. What are you talking about? I was really sad.
I was a little sad. I didn't find he was developed enough, but what I found really shocking there was two things. First, how suddenly it happens, because literally, like, between sentences, there's no slow build, there's no, oh, he was sick, no, he's dead. But I was really surprised that the author was willing to kill off the child character. They never do that.
It's also, in that point in the book, it's got a pretty sedate but kind of ongoing pace, so for anything to happen like that is kind of surprising.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, my second favorite scene in this book is this character called Typhon. Who is some former autarch or something, I think.
Yeah,
he was a former autarch. And his head has been grafted onto the body of his slave, Pyotan, who's running his autonomic functions for some reason. It was okay for his neurosurgeon to switch over the conscious functions to Typhon so he can walk around, but there's this other head on him, which is the original head on the body, but still the brain within that still running the hearts and guts and all these kind of things. And there's just this great bit where Severian has to deal with this character, because this character's threatening him. It's going to cause him a severe problem if he doesn't deal with him. And it's brilliant, because Severian, partly under Python's lip reading the words... because the other head cannot speak because he doesn't have access to the wind coming from the lungs, but he's sort of lipping, you know, the word, kill me, Severian. Severian goes, it is a little bit disappointing in Anatomy. He goes and he breaks the nose, a pite, and the actual body odor. And Typhon protects his own face. There's just this great image of this two-headed guy protecting the one face that is not being attacked and then dying. Unfortunately, he dies because Gene Wolfe says that he drives his nose bone into his brain. That's not actually a possible thing, but it's such a common trope. It's hard
really,
to untangle.
Really badass. Which is why he used it, I'm sure.
Probably.
Yes, I'm sure. Yeah.
Well, another scene that stood out for me is what I actually found was one of the saddest moments in the series is at the end of the third book, and this is a big spoiler, so if you don't want to hear it, turn this off now.
We just said you can't spoil this book.
This part you can. Terminus Est, the sword, actually gets broken.
Yeah.
Balbander is the big Frankenstein monster thing I mentioned. He's fighting Severian. He's got this like crazy glowing mace, which is some crazy sci-fi technology behind it. And Severian goes to block, and the sword actually, the blade gets shattered. And the reason this is sad is the role the sword plays in the narrative up to this point, it's very much a character. Like, it's an inanimate object, but it has a personality. It has these characteristics that make you sad when it's gone.
Also, Severian spends quite a lot of time running around trying to find it when it's been taken away or misplaced or something.
Description of the mercury hitting the water.
Yeah, the crying tears.
It's just absolutely beautiful.
It is, yeah.
Oh, there's a really funny scene just a few scenes prior to the one I described where Severian's on a boat with these fishermen and they've got these magic bullets. Which, I don't know what chemical element they are. They're in the same column as magnesium, though. So they get the way these things work is you shoot them out into the water. A minute later, they explode, come flying out, land in the water again, explode, come flying out, and just wreak all sorts of havoc.
I think it's probably like francium in layers of various...
Yeah, but it describes like, they're kept in this strange oily substance. It's mineral oil, so they don't explode in the air.
The guys who use them was very carefully drying off his hand before he touched one of these. It's a really funny thing.
I think you both covered most of my favorite scenes.
I thought you had one in the first book that
Yes, good on you for picking up the other stuff I was going to mention.
One of the
scenes that's really stuck with me, I actually think it's in the second one, because it's the first execution that Severian carries out in the text on the way to Thrax.
Mm.
And there's a woman getting executed, and then this other woman who wreaks her revenge using poisoned flowers that she brings up to the platform. Which is one of those really minor narrative things. In this case, it doesn't have anything to do with what happens later on. But it's just this minor little story detail that's just so fascinating that this little rivalry was happening and she got her revenge.
But I thought the, for you, Michael, the initial duel in the first book was a scene of yours that you liked.
Oh yeah, I really liked the flower duel, even though because it's not explained how Severian survived the touched by the poisonous flower in the duel, that I was just really confused at the end of it.
But I suppose you could say that because he will be the conciliator, it doesn't matter.
Yes, but we don't know that in the first book.
Oh, in the first book, right.
What's actually funny, you mentioned the execution scene, and that's another one of those unreliable narrator moments, because he even says, he's like, I'm describing this execution because it was important to me, because it was an early one, it was the first one I did, and I just found some of it particularly interesting. So if I don't describe any other executions, just take it as a given that I did them when I needed to, you know, get money to support myself and my travels. Which I think is an interesting point, considering how much of the book he stumbles around broke and starving.
Yeah. And that execution, though, is the second one. The first execution is the execution of Agilis in the first book.
Yes, sorry.
Yep. Oh, also, if anyone out there knows the answer to this question, I'd love to know what happened between the first book and the second book.
The famous doodle incident.
It is a doodle incident. My personal pet theory is Gene Wolfe's like, you know, I need these characters from point A to point B, and I don't really care how they get there. So
you have got to love how at the end of each volume, Severian closes out with just daring you to read on. This is difficult. You just wait.
Yeah. He's like, yeah, maybe this far. Oh, it's only gets worse.
I was going to say, we've elaborated on what a jerk he is, so I think there's just more evidence for you.
Yeah.
Which I gotta give Gene Wolfe credit for, because it's very easy to write characters that are likable, believe it or not. It's like, just make, give them every positive trait you wish you had. And it's like, they're happy, they're fun, they're smart, they're strong, they're this, they're happy. To write a truly convincing asshole who you don't know is an asshole till about halfway through the book is really hard to do.
And yet I want to know what he does anyway. And yet, what I find is deceptive in these books is that I dislike Severian, but I'm rooting for him the whole book because he has to win. Because I want him to win, because it's important that he wins. But I don't like him. I really don't like him. And it makes you feel skeegy. So Gene Wolfe got inside my head.
I think we've exhausted ourselves with our squeeing.
I think we have.
By no means have we exhausted the things we could talk about.
Oh no, there's a lot of things you could talk about in this book. We've only just scratched the surface with this conversation. And I hope the listeners who have read it, we've at least raised some points for further pondering and maybe confuse things even further, which isn't necessarily a bad thing.
And if anyone wants us to ponder further on more specific questions, feel free to ask us them, and we will, because, yeah, I'll revisit this.
Again, it's a good read. You have to read all four of them. They can't be taken as standalones. They can't be taken out of the context of they are a single work. Again, it's like committing to War and Peace. I found the payoff was worth it, so I would recommend it.
The payoff is worth it. It's definitely worth it.
Mm-hmm. And it's not to say that all these questions are stuff you only ponder internal to the text, because there are issues that are dealt with in this book about storytelling in general. How we structure our memories, how we tell stories about ourselves, how mythological figures arise, the stories that we make about them, the figures that they actually were as opposed to the narrative that arises around them, that are brought up in this book and explored in a very personal and deep way.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, what we've talked about are some details that stood out for us or some things that we found particularly challenging or frustrating, but we haven't even scratched the surface on this. Like, you could spend hours and days, and I'm sure at least one PhD thesis has been written on this. There's not much in it.
There are scholarly monographs about this. I think you could teach a course about this, a seminar course at a university level.
Yeah, and not
at a graduate student level. And still only start plumbing the depths of what's in this book.
And that's not on Gene Wolfe, that's on this one book.
And for those of you who may be, I don't know, somehow listening to this still, even though you don't particularly think that you might read this book, I challenge you to read it, because it's worth it. And if you can say that you got through the Book of the New Sun, then you can get through any book, my friend.
Yeah, over 1,000 pages of dense text. So, I think that brings us to a nice conclusion.
That was a good birthday present, guys. Thanks.
You're welcome.
I hope you enjoyed our rambling in this case, because we obviously got really involved in our conversation.
Hey, they should be grateful that we actually delivered on our promise to do a podcast on the Book of the New Sun sometime this year, and we delivered on that in 2 weeks of saying that.
So. Yeah, that's pretty good.
Yeah.
So thank you all for listening, and good day or good night.